No singular name is so connected with greatness like that of Alexander. The stories of his massive conquests fill the annals of history and inspired so many after him in both military strategy as well as personal accomplishment. A myth of one great conqueror about another stems from this type of comparison, in that Julius Caesar, who Plutarch wrote about, weeping having not reached the same level that Alexander had by that age. Caesar, the man we named the world's okayest pizza after, doesn't think he's good enough? Just so, how great was Alexander? Well, today we'll be looking through his extraordinary life into fact versus fiction as best that we can in his mythological life on another episode of The Remedial Scholar.
That's ancient history.
I feel I was denied critical need to know information.
Belongs in a museum, bro.
Stop skipping your remedial class.
Hello there, folks, and welcome back to The Remedial Scholar. I am your host, Levi, and today's an episode that I've been wanting to do for a long time. Before we get into it, I just want to run through a couple of things. Thank you for everybody who has so far rated and reviewed us wherever possible. Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can do it on some third-party apps as well. Also, check out the YouTube if you're new here or if you're a recurring listener. Check out the YouTube if you haven't yet. I put up pictures. Also, you can look at my face. But yes, you can look at pictures. Last episode, episode before that, were both episodes that I feel like really were benefited by having the addition of images, because some of the things either were very complex or you just kind of needed to see it to understand. And I enjoy that, and I think, you know, spread the wealth as far as listening goes. Like, obviously, it's nice to have it all on the podcast hosting site that I use, but also, if I can get a movement going on YouTube, that would be sweet as well. Also, in addition to that, merch. We got merch. I have found a space company that is, it's an agency, if you will, the National Agency for sidestepping all warnings, and they decided they wanted to, you know, partner with us and get some merch going. So I made this sweet design. If you were watching on YouTube, you would have been able to see that. So two-prong approach there. So if you go to the link in the description, all of the links are in the description. You can check out the merch, find out where the YouTube is, check out all of the things. If not, just share us wherever possible. That would be great. Let's move out from me begging for attention and into the actual topic at hand. So, before he was known as Alexander the Great, at least in the West, he was just Alexander III, King of Macedon. In modern times, we know of Alexander the Great as two things, both of the youngest and most prolific conquerors of the world. He was both of them. He was the sovereign of one of the world's largest empires, and to the Persians, which he fought in life, he was known as Alexander the Accursed, which now makes me contemplate the enemies of some of the most famous war people in history. Like, we think of them as like this triumphant and heroic thing, but like, I never really considered how their enemies thought about them until now. And now I want to know, that's all I want to know about them. Anyway, Alexander the Accursed. So we're going to go into some, we're going to find out if his honorable accolades and story bravado reflect the true nature of his character. All right, let's get into it. Actually, before that, I would say some not required material for this, but I would listen to the song Alexander the Great by Iron Maiden just to get you in the spirit. I would pause it right now and go listen to it. It's like 4 minutes long, but that was like my first introduction of Alexander the Great. That was before the movie with Colin Farrell came out, and it was really before I had Alexander like in any history classes, I believe, but I would check it out. It cracks me up how, you know, Iron Maiden has been able to bridge this gap of like really, really just awesome music and also teaching people things, like that bridging that gap of like, if I could somehow find a way to create artwork that also educated people with like a drawing or a painting as well as they do with their music, that would be, well, first of all, it might be impossible because they get way more they get way more words to use than I would have to do it visually. But anyway, check out the song. It's awesome. Other thing before I get too far along, any of my fellow Time Suck listeners might be like, hey man, I've already learned about Alexander the Great. I don't want you to leave because you've already heard it on a different podcast. I realize that. I would also like to point out that we did an episode about the Spartans before Dan did. So I'm just, we're kind of trendsetters if you think about it. I just, in my moment of pure ego, I'm like, he listened to that episode and was like, we gotta do this. But I know that's not how it worked, but it's fun to imagine things like that. So if you've heard about Alexander on a different podcast, I would recommend you don't leave because I still want you here with me. Because I am selfish a little bit. Anyway, now we can get into it. In our episode titled The Spartan Mirage, we touched upon a little bit of Hellenic history by detailing the meteoric rise and subsequent fall of the mythical military city-state of Sparta. On its coattails, the quote, backwater land of Macedonia rose triumphantly, ultimately galvanizing its position as the new Greek superpower from the smoldering ruins of Sparta's hubris. For context, I will revisit the series of historical events just to set the historical scene, if you will. From around 500 BCE, the rugged swath of land known as ancient Greece was the hub of development. Leaps and strides in the arts, culture, and warfare characterized this time. During this time, two great city-states, each with differing ideologies, duked it out in succession of battles and alliances. Athens, a hub of democracy, philosophy, and exuding great prowess in the military or in the naval arts, which we learned about both in the Sparta episode but also in the Pirates episode, if you remember that far back. They were at odds with the mysterious Sparta, who was militaristic, high austere, and largely feared for its large and capable army. 480 BCE, Athens and Sparta formed an alliance. As such, a contingent of Greek city-states led by a group of 300 Spartan men met the great threat of the age, the Persian Empire, in a narrow pass in what is now known as the Battle of Thermopylae. As we discussed in our episode on Sparta, the 300 men held off the horde for 3 days before ultimately meeting their deaths. The story of brazen military courage helped galvanize Sparta's reputation as being able to churn out our formidable soldier. The Persian force had its eyes on Greece and as such attempted to invade multiple times. At Salamis, the Greeks were able to defeat the Persians in naval battle. This had been in response to Persian forces under Xerxes sacking and burning Athens, destroying the Athenian Acropolis, which is pretty rude. The following year, the Greek alliance met at Persian army in a battle of Plataea, where they won. As such, the Persian invasion was staved off yet again. This kicked off around 50 years of relative peace and prosperity, a quote, golden age, if you will. However, tensions soon began to boil over once again for our age-old rivals, Athens and Sparta. Eventually, the two city-states would once again be embroiled in war, and Sparta would emerge victorious from the conflict of the Peloponnesian War. These two, Athens and Sparta, it's like Goku and Vegeta. Like, if you haven't watched Dragon Ball, you probably should. R.I.P. Akira. But Goku and Vegeta started off as rivals, and then like when a bigger bad guy comes in, they kind of team up and fight the other guy. Or you know, name your hero in a story. It happens in a lot of story. It's kind of a trope, but you know, that's just the one that comes in my head, mainly because Goku's like hovering over my right shoulder like a little angel, you know. I don't anyway, if you're on YouTube, you can see that. However, during the following decade, the city state of Thebes would revolt against Sparta, ultimately succeeding in defeating the superpower. Greece would then see a decade of turmoil play out as Thebes moved into an offensive strategy, unleashing a campaign after campaign in an attempt to consolidate and expand Theban power. Initially, this proved fruitful, and many city-states found themselves embroiled in conflict for years. However, this strategy ultimately left most, if not all, Greek city-states depleted in terms of resources, skilled fighting forces, and overall sense of partisanship. Thebes folded back into a defensive strategy, and the old Athenian superpower once again took its place at the center of the Hellenic political world. While this conflict brewed, a new power began to rise in the north. Regarded by the more cultured, quote, cultured city-states as a backwater mountain region, the Kingdom of Macedonia was not initially on the radar of the warring city-states to the south. However, Macedonia had quietly been undergoing a change, and the pieces were beginning to put into play for the rise of Macedonia. Described by some scholars as being on the periphery of classical Greek affairs. The Kingdom of Macedonia, sometimes called Macedon, was largely uninvolved and equally dismissed by the intricacies of political life and warfare in the southern city-state. This was until the ascent of King Philip II of Macedon. During his younger years, Philip was held hostage in Thebes. As a noble, he received an education in the military arts as well as the art of diplomacy. His educator was a man named Epaminondas, who, incidentally, was also the Theban general in charge of most of the offensive war that was waged against Sparta, and which led the led Thebes securing its place as the newfound hegemonic power of the time. So pretty great teacher to have, I would say. Philip returned to Macedon in 364 BCE, educated, as it were, in both politics and warfare. He was also infused with the expansionist ideology brought forth by the Theban generals at the time. He absorbed a lot of information there. He mused upon his return of implementing these very same ideals to the Macedonian banner. In 359 BCE, Philip ascended to the throne. He emboldened his people by getting the army, kind of galvanizing everybody together domestically. For example, he staved off an invading force of Paeonians and Thracians in eastern Macedonia, and also defeated 3,000 Athenian hoplites that were moving on Macedonia via a region called Methene. Also, the Thracians that I mentioned just a second ago, most notable place, birthplace of one Spartacus, so you know they're pretty good warrior folk up there. These conflicts cemented his capabilities as a ruler and starting wetting the palates of Macedon and the possibility of being a superpower itself. King Philip also implemented the phalanx infantry corps and outfitted them with 18-foot-long spears called sarissas, and this would be a game changer. I mean, if you can stab somebody 18 feet away, you're doing all right. I guess it wouldn't be a full 18 feet because you don't hold at the very end, but you go. Anyway, I digress. Macedon's rise to power was due to King Philip's military and diplomatic skills. Over the next 25 years, his kingdom would rise from, quote, backwater mountain kingdom to hegemonic superpower in Greece. Philip reformed the Macedonian army using his diplomatic skills to form alliances through marriages. He sacked cities rich in gold to fund his further campaigns, subjugated other city-states as vassal states, and asserted his power through the ideology of expansion. Now, vassal states are essentially just a state that pays tribute to you after you either give them an ultimatum. I learned this through Total War. I don't personally like doing vassal states because I don't get to control them in that game, but you know, essentially you in real life, you'd be like, hey, you like living, you like your life. All right, well, we're going to continue to let you do that if you just go ahead and give us money and some soldiers, and we just promise not to burn your city to the ground. That's essentially what was going on. In 338 BCE, King Philip waged war against the Theban and Athenian alliance at the Battle of Chaeronea. His army effectively crushed the alliance, having already subjugated most of the territories adjacent to Macedonia via alliance, marriage, or subjugation. Philip's victory at Chaeronea cemented his dominance over all of Greece, which was united under the banner of the Hellenic League, also known as the League of Corinth, of which Philip was, of course, the supreme leader or hegemon. The only city-state that was not part of this league was Sparta. Ever the outcast, man. do you think that has affected their reputation? Like, they're outcast, and in some weird turn of historical events, they've come back as like this fake macho society that we like look back retrospectively when really they didn't even like nobody even really wanted to deal with them. Like, even though they could conquer them, they're just not even worth it. This reminds me of, I like to watch the show Expedition Unknown, and the guy, I can't remember his name, goes to Greece and he goes to Sparta, and he's like, man, you would not know it, like in comparison to like Athens, like these other famous Greek places. Like, you go to Sparta and you'd have no idea of the history that is turned out by that, because it's so dull and like they have very little like care about the the reputation, I guess. I don't know. And I think that kind of speaks to what Sparta was back then more than anything, because you see Athens and you see these other places with these huge like temples all over the place and a lot of ruins that are like still kept thousands of years later, and Sparta's like, ah, history kind of forgot about us and then rewrote us into some Macho Man. Anyway, with the Hellenic League in place, King Philip set his sights on Greece's eternal foe, the Persian Empire. After centuries of plunder, the Persian Empire was beginning to show signs of weakness. Bolstered by a united front, Philip reasoned that the Hellenic League could take on the Persian Empire and amass untold riches and land in the process. Now, let's take a moment, backtrack a little bit. This is, of course, not the story of King Philip, per se, but King Philip's son, who, you might have guessed, was named Alexander. Around 357 BCE, King Philip met a fiery, orphaned redhead named Myrtale of Epirus on the island of Samothrace. She was the daughter of the late king of Epirus, a man named I forgot how how unfortunate it is for me to read Greek names. Neoptolemus. Yeah. Neoptolemus. Let's go with that. Intoxicated by her beauty and dispossession, she quickly became Philip's second wife, thus cementing an alliance between his forces and the kingdom of Epirus, which lay southwest of Macedonia. As I mentioned above, alliance by marriage was in the, you know, King Philip playbook, as it is. Something which was not uncommon at the time, pretty normal, I would say. On July 20th, 356 BCE, at Pella, birthplace of Windows. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, in Pella, in Macedonia, Alexander was born. On the day that Alexander was born, King Philip received three omens. The first was a message informing him that one of his generals, Parmenion, had been successful in battle. The second was news that his prized racehorse had won a race at the Olympic Games. Happy day! It was following this moment that Myrtale's name was changed to Olympius, which is easier to pronounce. The third event that was that, of course, Alexander was born, a son and heir apparent. It's said that a soothsayer purported that these events signaled that Alexander was, quote, destined for greatness. So, you know, I mean, it is good that you have that kind of, like, fortune for a child, but also holding them to a pretty high standard. No pressure, Alex. Anyway, young Alexander of Macedon was raised as a Macedonian noble, of course, and this came with all the privileges that his status entailed. He benefited from lessons of in the art of war, hunting, the scholarly arts, and was even privately taught by the legendary Aristotle himself, which is kind of, that's pretty big deal. I mean, I didn't get taught by Aristotle, so, you know, maybe the podcast isn't as great as it could be, but you know, I think we're doing pretty well because Aristotle, he's dead. Me, super alive. So who's the winner here? Alexander's mother, the newly minted Olympias, could be characterized by as a, you know, doting mother with high standards and even higher aspirations for her son. Weird, I know. But really, her goal was to make Alexander king. Boy moms, am I right? Historically, she is known as a bit of an eccentric. I described her earlier as being fiery. She was also known as tempestuous and broody. It is reported that she was a member of the cult of Dionysus and may have even introduced the act of snake wrangling into the cult's practices. I mean, what's the big deal? Yeah, you know, play with some snakes, worship a god, it's fine. It's also said that Olympias had received omens, specifically the night that she conceived Alexander, TMI, having dreamt of thunderbolt crashing to the earth and setting endless territories aflame. Olympias was certain that Zeus himself was her son, Alexander's father, a fact that she shared with him. So, overall, the implications here that Alexander's ego was lubed up for greatness from a very early age. High standards. Yeah, I just, that's what I just keep thinking of. Like, imagine a kid today, if you somehow could convince a kid today all of this, like, as they're growing up, it wouldn't last long because we have the internet and then everybody would kind of, actually, everybody would probably bully Alexander. It'd take Alexander to public school. He's getting bullied for sure. He's going to lose the ego immediately. By the age of 18, Alexander would join in on military campaigns led by his father. He was part of the campaign that defeated the Theban and Athenian alliance at Chaeronea in 338 BC, one of the most decisive battles of the age mentioned earlier. Alexander had become a capable noble in his own right and seemed on the fast track for the throne. Olympias and King Philip eventually found themselves in the midst of a bitter and contentious divorce. It is said that during this time, Olympias was incessantly whispering warring words in her son's ear. Perhaps her venomous words were infected by the taint of the looming divorce, Or perhaps this is simply par for the course to set the stage for Alexander's ascension. Like, who knows? Maybe she was going to do this even if they weren't going to, you know, get divorced. It is inferred that perhaps Olympia's words were meant to sway Alexander into questioning his father's overall intentions for him. Because after all, let's not forget that many marriages for the Macedonian ruler translated as many offspring vying for the throne. And I don't know if you know a whole lot about ancient Greece or ancient kingdoms in general, but if there's a bunch of siblings fighting for the throne, things can either get really bloody or really weird. Just ask Cleopatra. During this time, King Philip was set to remarry a Macedonian woman named Cleopatra Eurydice. No relation to the Cleopatra. As such, and perhaps the coalescing with Olympia's whispering into tangible reality, on the day of King Philip's wedding, Cleopatra's father, Attalus, toasted their marriage, alluding to the fact that, quote, any product of their union would be a true Macedonian heir. This hypothetical child, being a full-blooded Macedonian, would indeed have a better claim to the throne than a half-Greek, half-Macedonian Alexander. No doubt this toast stung a bit, as it is said that Alexander then blurted out, quote, then what am I, a bastard? He's a little hot-headed. He's also, I don't know the word that I'm looking for. Just the spoiled rich kid. Oh, okay, yeah, I'm not good enough. This wedding's horse shit. Before throwing a cup at Attalus's head. So, yeah, pretty much did that. Alexander's father, King Philip, then lunged at him, but fell over the table in a drunken stupor. After the wedding, Alexander and Olympias left in a self-imposed exile. In October of 336 BCE, the kingdom of Macedonia's capital, Aegea, King Philip was attending this wedding ceremony of his only daughter, Cleopatra. She was, you'll recall, Alexander's only full sibling, not to be confused with Philip's new wife, Cleopatra Eurydice. As the king walked into the capital's theater to welcome an onslaught of Greek diplomats, a blade was unceremoniously shoved into Philip's ribs from behind. Rude. The man behind the blade was named Ausonius of Orestes, a fellow Macedonian and King Philip's own bodyguard. So, historical records remain unclear as to why, but it is said that Pausanias was a former lover of King Philip, who he had left for a younger man. King Philip of Macedonia crumpled to the ground, dead. The true motivation behind Pausanias's actions are lost to history. Besides a personal vendetta, the other obvious reason could be that Pausanias was simply a pawn in Alexander and Olympia's line to the throne, because after all, who stood to gain the most from Philip's death at the time? You know, you really got to think of it like Law and Order, all right? Dun, dun. So, not a great time to be a king, also back in the day. They stabbed those people all the time. Everybody's getting stabbed. Alexander ascended to the throne, but keeping it was a kind of a different story. From the jump, securing his position required the quashing of rebellions. Often when a king dies, people get a little temperamental and things kind of erupt because people are unsure of what's going to happen next. So, he had some rebellions to quell, siphoning out traitors. He used a lot of brute force as a way to cement his power, even relying on the murder of some of Philip's other children from other marriages. Rude. One of the first people to go was Attalus, the man who had toasted the true Macedonian heir. So if you were wondering how petty Alexander was, very is the answer. Destroying any rivals was central to Alexander's strengthening of his title as king. Boils in the form of rebellion were popping up everywhere in the large Macedonian kingdom, but Alexander saw to it that each one was crushed, ending uprisings in Illyria, Thessaly, and central Greece. He particularly made an example of Thebes, reducing the city to dust and going so far as to sell Thebans into slavery. Not super pumped about the Thebans, I guess. In 334 BCE, Alexander of Macedon, at the age of 20, took it upon himself to move forward with the goal that had previously been espoused by his late father. He declared war on the Persian Empire. Iron Maiden, also in their song, says at the age of 19, he became the Macedon king, and then he swore to free all of Asia Minor. By the Aegean Sea in 334 BCE, he utterly beat the armies of Persia. I'm just saying, dude, Iron Maiden, they got it figured out. They got a system of teaching people stuff. They got really great guitar players. Anyway, I digress. At the time that this life goal was in its infancy, the Persian Empire had been around for over 200 years. This era in the empire is called the Achaemenid Empire. the first Persian Empire, and it was founded by Cyrus the Great in 550 BCE. It reached its peak under Xerxes I, who you'll recall was the emperor at the time of the Battle of Thermopylae. You know, he's like 8 feet tall, wears a diaper, has a gold chain from his nose to his ear. Pretty cool guy. That's a 300, the graphic novel adaptation reference, in case you were curious. When Alexander declared war on Persia, Darius III had been ruling over the empire for mere months. Darius had been counseled not to engage Alexander in war play. Unfortunately, he did not heed these warnings. And if you are a Time Suck listener, that is Daryl. The birth of Daryl. Nice. And I had to get that out of my head before I continued. In the spring, Alexander and his army crossed the Hellespont, a narrow strait in present-day northwest Turkey, kicking off one of the greatest military campaigns in history. At its peak, Alexander's army consisted of roughly 32,000 to 40,000 men from all parts of Greece. I will walk us through a great breakdown of a breakdown of the general composition of this army. Its infantrymen were commanded by Parmenion, a legendary Macedonian general who had also served under King Philip. At the front of the army formation were around 9,000 Macedonians, all bearing the 18-foot-long sarissas that we mentioned. These men were highly skilled professionals who ascribed the aforementioned phalanx formation, which in this case ran 16 ranks deep because of the sarissa's length and the sheer volume of the phalangite soldiers making up the front of the ranks. Maneuverability and vulnerability were issues. In other words, the soldiers were particularly vulnerable on the flanks of the formation as well as their backs. But, you know, flanks would be your sides and then like complete opposite the backside. Think of spinning around quickly to defend yourself whilst wielding a giant 18-foot rod. Not the most effective. To remedy this situation, a contingent of 3,000 men dubbed Hypaspis, or shield bearers were positioned on either side of the front flanks to protect them. These men were armed with short spears, felicitating their ability to defend fellow soldiers. These men were led by Parmenion's son, Nicanor. The second rank of the army consists of 12,000 hoplites, consisting of 7,000 Greek allies and 5,000 mercenaries. These men also carried a short spear as well as a rounded shield called the hoplon. Alexander's army also consisted of 1,000 Agrians, expert javelin throwers from a territory that now corresponds to southern present-day Bulgaria. The army also consists of other skirmishers or light infantry such as 1,000 archers, 6,000 Illyrians, and Thracians armed with slings and bows. But this is not all. Along with this whole group of soldiers was the Campanian Cavalry, 1,800 armed men on horseback, with a man named Philotas at the helm. He was another of Parmenion's sons. Parmenion, he had a pretty decent dynasty going on. As well as 1,800 Thessalian Cavalry, 600 Greek Cavalry, and 900 scouts from the region of Paeonia and Thrace. When Alexander crossed the Hellespont, he landed in Persian soil with 18,100 men in tow. Now, it's interesting to think of this assortment of Greek fighters all thrown into the mix together. Many of these soldiers all spoke different languages, and as we know, they would have maybe even fought against each other in previous battles. This, coupled with the fact that Alexander was such a young leader, sowed seeds of doubt and disarray in the beginning of the campaign. However, Alexander's army would soon be swayed by his military and tactical prowess. At the time, the Persian Empire was divided into provinces or satrapies. Upon hearing about Alexander's military desires, the provinces' rulers or satraps, collectively known as the satraps of Asia Minor, were meeting to decide what the best course of action to undertake in order to fend off this young, restless Macedonian ruler were. Now, let's get back to Darius for a moment. As I mentioned earlier, Persia's emperor at the time didn't heed the advice of his intelligence officers. The advice had been shared by Greek spies and others in service of the emperor, such as a satrap named Memnon of Rhodes, who was Greek general in the Persian service. Memnon even suggested alternative tactic that the scorched earth policy. He advised to burn and destroy all fields and towns on the periphery of the empire and retreat to the imperial core. This tactic would cause Alexander's army to starve, and they would, he reasoned, be forced to retreat. Now, Darius did not heed any of this advice and deployed a force of around 14,000 men to meet Alexander in battle. The emperor himself was not present at this battle, however, so unfortunate for Alexander's sake. It was led by the satraps of the region of Asia Minor and most notably the Arsites of the satrap of Hellespontine Phrygia. Greek names are hard to say. And our friend Memnon of Rhodes, remember him? Little spy action, gets his feet wet. This army also included around 2,000 Greek mercenaries in the service of the Persian Empire. So, in what is now present-day Turkey, Alexander and Darius's armies met at the river Granicus for what would be the first of three important battles on Persian soil. The river was shallow, nearly 60 feet wide, with very steep embankments. It's said that this first battle showcased what was outwardly perceived as Alexander's quote, thoughtless abandon in battle. He ignored advice to wait until dawn to attack and proceeded immediately. He was at utmost helm of his ranks and charged the forces into battle wildly. During this battle, Alexander very nearly lost his life when he suddenly found himself surrounded by a swarm of Persian nobles. One of these nobles, named Rosasus, nearly landed a deadly blow to Alexander's head. However, it is said that the strike merely shattered his helmet, leaving him concussed, but otherwise unharmed. He retaliated by striking down Rosasus with his lance. Shortly after, legend has it that another Persian noble named Spithridates charged Alexander from behind, his sword raised and sure to make a killing blow. Just then, Cletus the Black, yeah, let's go, dude. One of Alexander's generals severed the arm of the assailing Persian enemy and struck him down. Tales like this, as well as the smattering of myths and legends, are infused in many Alexander's historic military feats. Now, you'll recall the inference of Alexander's chaotic initial charge. Well, it turns out that this impulse was not so chaotic after all. The commotion of the cavalry's initial charge was actually meant as a distraction. This is because Alexander's so-called, quote, superior infantry, the 9,000 professional Macedonian soldiers armed with the sarissas, were meant to be safely crossing the river while the Persian cavalry and infantry were, destined to be preoccupied at fending off the frenzied front ranks. This tactic proved surprisingly successful and would set the tone for the next 18 months. Alexander ultimately defeated the Persian forces at Granicus. He also made an example of 2,000 Greek mercenaries who fought in service to the empire. Judging them as traitors, they were surrounded from all sides by Alexander's forces and promptly massacred on sight, which is kind of crazy to me. I mean, I get it. You want to set the tone, but also they're mercenaries. Like, they could just work for you, dude. Anyway, with the battle at the river of Granicus behind him and the rest of Asia Minor ready for the taking, Alexander set off to conquer the rest of the Persian Empire. With news of defeat of the satraps of Asia Minor, the rest of the empire, aging but full of riches, began bracing itself in retaliation. On the banks of Granicus, Darius, unlike Alexander, had not been present. Fueled by this, Alexander marched on, seeking a battle with the so-called King of Kings, Darius III. Alexander and his army marched through the province of Lydia. Remember them? Lydian stones, we talked about that in the, that was the, holy cow, that was the dogs episode, the war dogs, the very beginning, where it all started, brother. Anyway, marched through the province of Lydia, easily overtaking the city of Sardis, which surrendered without a fight. Judging that the Persian naval fleet needed to be subdued before further campaigning could be undertaken, Alexander overtook the coastal cities of Miletus and Halicarnassus on the Aegean coast. This assured that his lines of transportation and communication to Greece remain open, free, and clear, and both cities put up a fight but were ultimately overtaken by winter. Remember, we started this campaign in the spring. Next, Alexander marched on the provinces of Lydia and Phrygia, where he stopped to marvel at the so-called Gordian Knot. Here we have another instance where legend colors the life of Alexander. Supposedly, the Gordian Knot was a complex knot that could only be untied by whoever be destined to be the supposed ruler of all of Asia. The Asia Minor version of the Arthurian legend of Excalibur, if you will. Reportedly, instead of spending time laboriously and meticulously trying to solve the untangle the knot, it is said that Alexander simply just cut the knot with his sword, displaying, you know, in some sense of a stroke of genius and others, brute strength. Framing and truth of this story is important. In one hand, it can be perceived that Alexander actually showcased how ill-suited he was for sustainable rule by his impatience and youthful petulance. On another, it could be read as a display of his think outside the box approach. It can also be totally fake, another tall tale meant to boost his aura and let stories of his deeds precede him during his campaigns, setting the satraps scrambling, you know. Meanwhile, the empire, for its part, attempted to organize an offensive strike against the Hellenic League, led by Memnon of Rhodes, who had survived the Battle of the River of Granicus. A Persian fleet penetrated the Aegean and overtook the island of Chios and Lesbos. Hello. However, I'm such a child. However, Memnon suffered a sudden death, and the retaliation was abandoned. This leads us to the second major battle undertaken by Alexander and his army. In 333 BCE, after 18 months of campaigning, Alexander and his men kept marching further into the Empire's territory. They traversed the province of Cilicia and were positioned at the base of the Nur Mountains, hoping to cross over into Syria. There, they were surprised by the Persian royal army, led by Darius himself. By God, it's him with the chair, who ambushed them from the north. Darius's goal to ambush in this ambush was to trap Alexander. He had the element of surprise on his side, and he had his men outnumbered Alexander 2-1. In order to prevent Alexander from retreating, Darius positioned his men in the coastal plains near the ancient town of Issus, near the mouth of the river, which stretched 6 miles from the base of the Nur mountain range to the sea, effectively blocking Alexander's only escape route. Some scholars go so far as to estimate that Darius's army, the main Persian army, had up to 100,000 men. Numbers vary, but it is widely accepted that at Issus, Alexander was outnumbered. It is also important to note in stories like this, especially Alexander, like big name people like this, that he ends up winning, right? He wins so that his numbers are tilted to make him look more impressive. So it is worth noting that that number might be dubious. It might have been an even match, but he was also, you know, surprised. However, Darius's choice to trap Alexander's army in the coastal plain also put the King of Kings himself at a disadvantage, since he was unable to use the full number of his men at once on the narrow battlefield. Darius's army was formidable in both skill and numbers. For one, his personal retinue called the Immortals were an elite group of heavy infantry, at least 10,000 strong. He's also flanked by 11,000 cavalry and at least 10,000 Greek hoplite mercenaries, among others. Darius held his position behind the Pinarus River and waited for Alexander to make the first move. Surprisingly, Alexander, outnumbered, was eager to charge, and charged so he did, quickly, at the head of his army's right wing after having roused his men with an inflamed and personal speech. This was also very part and parcel to the myth of Alexander. He always gave these rousing speeches. He very much the Mel Gibson Braveheart of his generation. Initially, much as they had been at Granicus, the Persian army was shocked by the Hellenic forces' surprising and speedy charge. Soon, the Macedonian phalanx hit a bit of a snag. It was unable to keep up with the charge of Alexander's speed of Alexander's charge. Seeing that his prized fighters were being pushed back, Alexander redirected his own group, the Companions, to aid the fighting and made sure that the 1,800 Thessalian cavalry could also boost the infantry under Parmenion's command near the coast. Soon enough, the phalanx began advancing again, protected once more from its vulnerable points by Alexander's astute military tactic. Alexander, for his part, actively charging into the Persian horde. He was, you guessed it, looking, searching for Darius himself. It is said that Darius, upon seeing the fearless Macedonian king, fled the battle in his royal chariot. Man, that is why, like, say what you want, myth building, anything like that, but there is something about the generals of the ancient world who would lead their battles. Like, Caesar was one, and Alexander's another one. I know there's more, I just can't think of any, but like, that, like, lead by example to the most literal degree. Is there something to be said about that? Parmenion held steady as he and his men fought against the Persian cavalry. It could have been an overwhelming defeat if it wasn't for the fact that word was beginning to spread on the Persian front that Darius had fled the battlefield. This spurred his troops to dissolve. As such, the Persian soldiers began fleeing in droves. Quickly, the tone of the battle shifted, as soldiers on foot were largely massacred, having been pursued by the Hellenic cavalry until the light of day ran out. Around 40,000 Persians would lose their lives in the Battle of Issus. This would also mark the beginning of the end of the Persian Empire. Needless to say, Alexander weaseled and won his way out of Darius's trap, and his ego and winning streak kept inflating, just like NASA and their successful missions. Not to be confused with Nassau, which is a completely different thing. The battle marks another instance where Alexander displayed no hesitation. It was also fearless in his charging his foes head on. This does lie in contrast to Darius's approach, which relied on the element of entrapment and also showcased how much of a scary cat he really was. Aw, poor Darius. He's just a timid little fellow. In Darius's panic to escape and ultimately self-preserve, he left behind his wife, Statiria, his mother, and three of his children, including his daughter, Statiria II, and Drip Gepetus. Alexander took them as prisoners of war. It was reported, luckily, that they were all taken alive and treated well, with hostages in tow and another decisive victory for the Hellenic League under his belt. Alexander set his sights on the western borders of the empire, having, you know, kind of galvanized control of all of the Asia Minor, as also known as Anatolia, which constitutes most of present-day Turkey. The following year, in 332 BCE, Alexander campaigned along the coastal province of Phoenicia, overtaken port cities along the way. Thus, he effectively took away Persian control of the Mediterranean Sea, another big win. One city, however, proved resistant, and that was the city of Tyre, and it was, in fact, an island, which some would think would create an obvious problem for potential invaders. Alexander remedied this by building a causeway to the island, reinforced by two siege towers with catapults designed to breach fortifications. After 7 months of skillful fighting on both sides, Tyre eventually fell. It was said that most of the citizens were killed or enslaved. When the walls of Tyre fell, Alexander solidified his control of Levant, somewhat analogous to the political region of the Middle East. Geographically, it is comprised of the Eastern Mediterranean region of West Asia as well. And he was not happy about having to wait so long to capture that city. That's why he killed all those people, for sure. Alexander marched on towards the Persian province of Egypt, landing at its proverbial gates by accessing the city of Pelusium. There, the Persian governor of Egypt quickly surrendered the entire province. He's like, I don't even worry about it. Here's the keys. As such, he was given access to the royal treasury. No doubt feeling invincible at the time, Alexander marched on, this time to Memphis. In ancient Egypt, Memphis was one of the oldest cities and most important as well. It was located on the entrance of the Nile River Valley near Giza Plateau. Memphis was once the capital of ancient Egypt and had many sacred connotations, as it was the spiritual place of worship. There, Alexander was welcome as the liberator of Egypt against the Persian Empire. As such, Alexander was swiftly crowned pharaoh, which certainly added to his personal mythos as well. As pharaoh, he traveled to the mouth of the Nile River, founded a new city, Alexandria. Wow, wonder where he came with that name. Following the super Loki move, he is said to have traveled to the desert oracle of Siwa, where the priests name him son of Amun, king of the gods. So, kind of adding to this ego a little bit. In Egypt, Alexander spent time restoring temples that had been ruined under Persian rule and built new temples to honor Egyptian gods. Now, let's take a little break from Alexander's illustrious series of wins, both professional and personal, to highlight in the face of all this glory in Egypt, many in Greece still viewed Alexander as nothing more than a tyrant. Sure, he was laying waste to the age-old enemy of the Hellenic world, but Macedonian displays of power and force, participation of city-states in the Hellenic League, had brewed dissidents in Greece. In 331 BCE, Alexander traveled back to Tyre, where he was made aware of various factions that were creating trouble, namely the Spartans and Thracians. As such, Alexander's representatives in Greece, namely his commander Antipater, meet the Spartans in battle at the Megalopolis, which is not a name for a really cool mall, but it should be. Spartan army led by King Aegis of Sparta was defeated. This no doubt encouraged Alexander to keep maintaining his campaign in Persia. You know, hey, they got it settled back home. I can just keep on going. As such, he soldiered on to the Persian heartland, seeking out his cowardly foe, King Darius himself. Also, I want to take note of his style of occupation. Like, when he captured Egypt, he forced the Persians out, rebuilt their temples, and it was like more of a synchronicity of cultures instead of like cultural domination. He's like, you can keep your stuff, like you do you. And that was kind of his style. And that's why a lot of the places that he would capture, I feel like it was, you know, it helped his personal brand, like his public relations was really good because of stuff like this. While Alexander had been finishing up his time in Egypt, it is said that he had received a letter from King Darius. Records state that in this letter, Darius states that he is prepared to forgive Alexander for his transgressions, as they had once been allies. He only asked that his family be returned to him. According to the Greek historian Arrian of Nicomedia, in his work titled The Anabasis of Alexander, detailing Alexander's military campaigns, Alexander responds to Darius with a sick burn, quote, "In future, whenever you communicate with me, send me as king of Asia. Do not write me as an equal, but state your demands as master of all your possession. If not, I shall deal with you as a wrongdoer. If you wish to lay claim to the title of king, then stand your ground and fight for it. Do not take flight, as I shall pursue you wherever you may be." In other words, he wanted Darius to fight him, in case that wasn't super clear. Some sources say that as a bargaining ploy, Darius offered him a fortune of gold, his daughter's hand in marriage, and half of the Persian Empire in exchange for peace. Now, at this point, fresh from a series of victories, proclamations of greatness from childhood, desert oracles stating he was the son of the gods, squashing his enemies back home, it's safe to say that Alexander has a little bit of momentum. Darius's proposal was rejected, and Alexander was coming to take it all. In 331 BC, Alexander had received word that a great portion of the Persian army was stationed at Gaugamela, present-day southern Kurdistan. He seized the opportunity to finalize his dominance over Persia, overtake Darius once and for all. Perhaps having learned from the bottlenose disadvantage of Issus, Darius chose to meet Alexander's forces in battle on a wide band of open ground. His soldiers labored to make the ground propitious for Persian chariots, cavalry, and infantry. For his part, Alexander chose to cross over to Gaugamela using a northern route as opposed to the southern route, which would have been a more predictable option. As crossing the Euphrates River in the summer of 331 BCE and heading north, Alexander was able to take advantage of a cooler temperature that made traveling easier, and his troops were able to forage for food. Had they taken the southern route, as historians think, Darius anticipated, they would have been met with a scorched earth series of towns, villages, and fields, ran low on supplies, and may have ultimately suffered losses due to hunger and heat exhaustion. Either way, when the two foes met at Gaugamela, they were itching for a fight and some resolution, be it death or surrender. Darius's army was, of course, made up of contingents from subjects across the empire. Syrians, Babylonians made up some of the infantry, Armenians and Indians formed part of the cavalry, chariots, and even elephants were part of the war effort. Once again, Alexander's army was outnumbered 2-1. He deployed his forces as per usual and engaged his first line of attack. Greek cavalry, led by Parmenion on the left and the trusted Greek companions on the right, the veteran Greek phalanx with the sarissas at the center. No doubt, animated by his seemingly unstoppable destiny, Alexander charged first from his own right wing. This, of course, was shocking to the Persian force, which hilarious because this has happened 3 times now. It seems shockingly that Alexander was leading his contingent army to the huge Persian army. They could not imagine that he was attempting to then encircle them. In order to meet and disrupt him, the Persians dispatched their own cavalry contingent, meeting Alexander and his men in the area groomed for Persian chariots. Persian chariots at the front and center of the Persian line were dispatched, but many of them were taken down by a group of skilled javelin throwers on the Hellenic line. Greek infantry allowed Persian chariots to cross their lines, leading them head on with the phalanx. This dislodging of the Persian line had caused their center to weaken, and it was a trap. It's a trap. Alexander signaled for his Greek phalanx at the center and the front to engage. He persevered towards the center of the Persian army, attempting to find King Darius himself. Meanwhile, shaken by the ferocity of the attack, the Persian soldiers began to retreat. And who was with the fleeing soldiers? Well, wouldn't you know it, it's Darius again. Meanwhile, Alexander's general, Parmenion, was in trouble. He had been surrounded by enemy cavalry, was succumbing to the battle. Alexander, in hot pursuit of his rival, gave up chase, turned around to defend his soldiers. That's a good leader. It was a bloody battle, and Alexander lost 60 of his most trusted companions. Once again, news of Darius' cowardly escape trickled through his army, and the last of his cavalry turned and fled. In the battle, Alexander's victory was absolute. This win had ended the Persian Empire, and all its territories were now to be claimed. Alexander marched to Babylon, the heart of the Persian Empire, where he was stunned by its hanging gardens and streets lined with flowers. In only 6 years, the young man, he was barely 25 at the time, had defeated the Persian Empire. He had been named Pharaoh of Egypt, and he was now set to be crowned King of Kings and the administrative capital of the Persian Empire. The city of Susa, with all its glory in such a short time and at such a young age, one would almost be led to believe that Alexander was a god. But he was no god. He was just a man. After his remarkable defeat of the Persian Empire, it is said that Alexander developed a habit of drinking to excess. At the city of Persepolis and ceremonial capital of the empire, it is said that in a drunken stupor, he ordered the city to be sacked and burned as revenge for burning of Athens and the disruption of the Acropolis a whole 150 years before that. This was an impulsive decision that Alexander came to regret, as hundreds of years of art, culture, and history had been destroyed in the inferno. What's more, when sober, Alexander had expressed that he wanted to be received as a legitimate successor to King Darius. Can only imagine how ill-received this drunken display of power looked in the eyes of the people he was now going to subjugate, right? Out of all his victories, one lingering sentiment of dissatisfaction emerged. You'll recall that after all these wins, Darius was still on the run. He was a mark on Alexander's perfect record. As such, Alexander set off after him, knowing that he sought refuge in the city of Ecbatana. By the time he reached the city gates, Darius, the fugitive king, had already fled east, also regrouping an army at the provinces of Bactria, Parthia, and Sogdia. But as it was in those days, the courtly rivalries got Darius before Alexander did. He had been betrayed and killed by his own general, Bessus, before Alexander could get a hold of him. Bessus, for his part, took up where Darius left off and proclaimed himself ruler of the empire. Alexander bestowed a proper burial onto Darius and treated him as the king in death. Over the years, even if Darius's family were technically hostages, they had grown quite close with Alexander and he to them. So close, in fact, that it is said that he began adopting Persian forms of dress. Alexander's countrymen, for their part, although they understood the necessity of integrating himself in the eyes of the Persian people, were beginning to resent their young ruler. Alexander began demanding that his officers, many of them fellow Greeks, kiss him on the hands and bow to him when he was addressing them. This was known as the ancient Persian ritual of proskynesis. These acts were, in the eyes of Greeks, reserved for the gods, not mortals. As such, they took great offense to his demands. In a 0 to 100 flip that perfectly illustrates the courtly drama of the times, the resulting response to his demands were, behind the scenes, attempts on Alexander's life. In 330 BCE, one of his men, Philotas, admitted that he knew of a plot against Alexander's life, but did not inform the ruler immediately. Alexander's response was to execute Philotas as well as his father. You might remember him, the legendary general Parmenion. There's no proof that Parmenion was in any way involved in the plot to assassinate Alexander. As we have to come to know, Parmenion had been instrumental in securing Alexander's most momentous victories. This was not a good look. Alexander seemed to devolve into paranoia, however. His fears were not unfounded. Let's not forget that mere 6 years earlier, his own father had been assassinated, and he had just found a plot against him. So, kind of makes sense. Alexander was pushing his fatigued army further and further into Asia, chasing Darius's killer, the usurping Bessus, through province after province, until finally, in 328 BCE, they arrived at the edge of their empire, the Persian Empire. There, he names another city after himself, Alexander Estate, meaning furthest Alexandria. At the city of Kunduz, Bessus was captured, betrayed by his own men, who offered him up in chains. He sent him off to Persia to be executed as a kingslayer. Still unsatisfied, Alexander remained in the border provinces, fighting a lengthy guerrilla war with local tribes. These drawn out and frustrating battles were beginning to irk his troops, who by now had been fighting for many years. Their frustration also stemmed from the fact that Alexander seemed to be insatiable, his conquests endless. The same year, 328 BCE, during a drunken night of revelry with his friends, Alexander boasted that his conquests were greater than any man before him, including those of his father, King Philip. Cletus the Black, the same man who had severed the arm of the assailant during the first battle of Granicus, disagreed with Alexander's statement. In a drunken and rageful response, Alexander threw a spear at his chest, killing him instantly. You'll recall that Cletus was a man who quite literally saved Alexander's life. This impulsive response garnered a second assassination attempt, further driven a wedge between him and his Macedonian counterparts. In 327 BCE, Alexander married the daughter of a Bactrian nobleman. Her name was Roxana. Roxanne, you don't have to burn them, but I know it's Roxanne, not Roxana, but just anyway. And he married after supposedly falling in love with her at first sight. This marriage was highly strategic, as it quelled the local dissent in the empire's most eastern provinces. The fact that Alexander chose a Persian wife so late in life, 29 years old, in fact, angered his men further. In their eyes, he had chosen Persia once again over his Macedonian allegiance. Alexander set his sights on modern-day India and Pakistan, but his army was at the end of its rope. Hearing rumbles of a gray army in the east had preemptively deflated Alexander's army after suffering their most crushing battle in terms of lives lost, the Battle of Hydaspes. In 326 BCE, the army made a collective demand to return home, a mutiny, essentially, during the Battle of Hydaspes. The forces of King Porus had deployed battle elephants, which greatly wounded the soldiers on Alexander's side. This confirmed their wildest fears that an army composed of millions of men and strange beasts waited for them in India. Frustrated, Alexander obliged, and after 8 years of campaigning, the armies returned. The voyage home took them around 2 years. Some of Alexander's men, led by Nearchos, looks like nachos to me, maybe I'm hungry, took the route through Persian Gulf, exploring waters that had previously never been sailed by the Greeks. As for Alexander, he marched across the Gedrosian Desert, where he and his men suffered greatly under the threat of starvation and dehydrated. Once he arrived at Persepolis, he undertook what is known as the Purge of the Viceroys and executed many of the men that he had left behind in his rule in absence, judging that they had desecrated and robbed ancient temples. In 324 BCE at Ecbatana, Alexander's lifelong friend and possible lover, Hephaestion, died suddenly at the age of 32. This passing set Alexander down a dark and depressive spiral. He refrained from eating and drinking for days, and he even had the physician who tended Hephaestion executed. I'm sure they were just roommates, though. He shaved his head as a sign of mourning. That same year, at the city of Susa, Alexander married off 80 of his Macedonian officers to Persian noblewomen, reinforcing ties between the nations. He himself married his second and third wives at these communal weddings. One of the wives was the daughter of his lifelong frenemy, Darius III. Her name, if you'll recall, was Stateria II. The other was named Parisitis II. And she was the daughter of Artaxerxes II. So many juniors. Stateria Jr., Perististus. I can't speak. These marriages laid his claim to the last of the Achaemenid lineage of Persian king. In 323 BCE, Alexander and his men decided to rest in the ancient city of Babylon. There, he received tributes and visits from dignitaries from many corners of the world. All prostrated themselves before his greatness. At 32 years old, Alexander remained undefeated in battle. In less than a decade, he had overtaken the centuries-old Persian Empire. He was Alexander the Great. You know, this is the thing. It was like Alexander wept, seeing as he had no more worlds to conquer. This is that point, right? At Babylon, he began planning his campaign to Arabia. There, he and his men engaged in a tradition that they had always partaken in, one such stay: drunken revelry. Never one to shy away from a party. Functioning alcoholism, anyone? Alexander surprised his friends and retired early that evening. On another night, shortly after, Alexander challenged his friends to a drinking game, but then had to excuse himself back due to stabbing pains in his back. Over the next couple days, his condition would deteriorate rapidly as he developed a fever, lost ability to talk. In a dramatic end, Alexander would transfer over his power by placing his signet ring in the hands of his senior general, Perdiccas. On June 11th, 323 BCE, Alexander died of an illness that has yet to be historically confirmed. Records show that he battled sickness for another 2 weeks. It could have been a myriad of things. Sickness ran rampant. He was also not a man known for taking care of himself. His death could have been an infectious disease or poisoning. When Alexander died, there was no clear plan of succession. At the time of his death, Roxana, pregnant with a son who would name Alexander IV, of Macedon immediately upon finding out Alexander died, it is said, although not confirmed, that Roxana Stateria had Stateria II and Parisatis had both of them executed. Either way, she might not have done it, but those two women were assassinated in 323 BCE. Alexander's son, in turn, would never rule, as he would be poisoned around the age of 13 or 14 years old. Alexander's legacy is poignant and complex, although he has been greatly immortalized for his greatness millennia after his exploits. Did seem greatly blinded by endless ambition. His early life set him on a track for some supernatural success, and it leads one to wonder if destiny informed the man or if he was informed by his destiny. One thing is for sure, he was just a man, plagued by excess, blinded by hubris, and overcome by grief, just like all of us. So that's it. Alexander the Great. We did it. We escaped the 20th century. Hooray. There's like four or five episodes where we were in the 20th century and I knew we were going to go back in time, but you know, it's just the way things lined up. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode. You know, a lot of information. There's a lot going on with Alexander and, you know, just kind of the geopolitical landscape that he found himself in. But again, I recommend listening to the Iron Maiden song, you know, just to really get your mojo around Alexander and who he was and what he did and everything like that. I mean, here's the thing. And I was thinking this whole time, but the movie with Colin Farrell, people hate that movie. I don't really understand it. I thought it was great. And, you know, until another better version comes along, that's what we got for Alexander the Great movie. I do kind of often wonder about the people he conquered. Like, I know he did a little bit of like an assimilation, like synchronicity kind of thing where, you know, you can keep your beliefs, but I'm your overlord, essentially. Like the Macedonian umbrella is what you're under, but you believe what you want. And I think that is probably the biggest part of his legacy, not in terms of like that was the most important part, but I think that influenced how people reacted about him after the fact. Obviously, very, very impressive for battles, military strategy, you know, he undefeated the whole time, but I think that the way that he, when he conquered places, for the most part, there's the asterisks because he like demolished Tyr and killed everybody or sold them into slavery. So there's, you know, yeah, he's human. But I think that how he handled those situations, for the most part, really influenced how people would talk about him retrospectively with like the ancient historians. But yeah, I hope you guys all enjoyed this episode. I know I, as always, enjoyed it. I do enjoy the ancient historical texts. And I don't know. My imagination runs wild in those kinds of stories. And I imagine them very vividly. It's very fun for me. But, you know, if not, hey, guess what? You can click in the description, go to Linktree, and you can find out where you can submit a topic for a suggestion if you would like to do that. Otherwise, you can leave a comment in the Facebook group or on the Facebook page on the Instagram post that I put out every week or every episode. I said every week. I haven't gone back up to weekly schedules. Don't get your horses all riled up. But otherwise, you can comment on the YouTube video, in the Facebook group, on Facebook itself, on the Facebook page. And that's the best way to do it. You can also email me. There's a Linktree button for topic suggestions. The Linktree, wherever you're listening to this, it's in the description. Click that and then it'll ask you to leave your email and you can type in your topic suggestion for that. So do that if you're interested in anything like that. If you have any feedback, you know, I'm all ears. I obviously am doing this mostly just for me because I enjoy these topics and I enjoy teaching people things. But, you know, I am I will accept feedback. I do like to know when things aren't going as good as they could be. So please let me know. Be honest. I can take it. I'm a grown man. I only cry a little bit. So, but that is it for this episode. Looking forward to sharing more with you in the future. Until then, you have a great rest of your week whenever you're listening to this, and we will see you next time.